Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film historian and curator Alicia Fletcher and Norm Wilner, senior film writer of Now Magazine and host and producer of the Someone Else's Movie podcast and the Now What podcast. When I started watching both of our movies today, I immediately thought about how once studios got a look at the box office numbers and accolades of Lord of the Rings, they started throwing out green lights for historical epics while hoping for greenbacks. However, our film guru guest today, Norm Wilner, pointed out to me that the trend goes even further back. And of course, he was right. Norm, what kind of risks are studios taking on when they greenlight these kinds of historical war epics, and how big do they have to hit to inspire more like them? Like, we very rarely get a Lord of the Rings kind of movie.
Yeah, well, the Lord of the Rings sort of supercharged the idea of epics for a bit, but they had already been rolling out. It goes back to my mind, both of these films, both Kingdom of Heaven and The New World, are sort of rooted in the success of Gladiator the year before The Lord of the Rings came out, which was a blockbuster and an Oscar winner. And, you know, it's kind of Ridley Scott remaking The Fall of the Roman Empire with a couple of bigger, well, more with more methody actors, really, more than anything else, and some terrible CG, which we're all willing to forgive because, you know, that was the style at the time. But Gladiator came from Braveheart, which was the 1995 Oscar monster and box office success from Mel Gibson, which was basically just Spartacus. But it was proof that the old action epic formulas from the 60s, from the Roadshow era of giant 70mm eye-popping exclusive engagements and audience grabbers would bring people back to the movies. And of course, Braveheart and also Rob Roy the same year came from The Last of the Mohicans, when Daniel Day-Lewis and Michael Mann made their wilderness epic. And it's a very different, like, it's a much more intimate action movie. It doesn't have giant action sequences the way that Braveheart would bring those back. But what that did was every major male actor who wanted to be an action star in the early 90s just pointed at The Last of the Mohicans and said, get me one. I want to do that. He can do that. I can do that.
If I can wear a loincloth and paint my face, I am right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That film scarred me when my parents showed it to me when they rented it. And around the time that it had come out, like, I remember I had probably never seen a Michael Mann film. That would have been my first at like 10 years old. And it really disturbed me. Like, it's got some, I haven't watched it since, but I can remember so many visuals of the young woman jumping off the waterfall and all this, like, traumatizing.
Yeah, it's not the sweeping romance people think it is.
No, one of ours is intended to be a sweeping romance and also fails at that as well, which we're going to be discussing about today.
I disagree. We're going to.
I know. It's okay. The fisticuffs are on, but they're genteel fisticuffs. This is our first episode of 2005, and coming from 1997, one of the biggest talking points we found was that is a huge turning point of practical effects meets CGI, and now we're in 2005, and CGI is really going to be facilitating a lot of these epic films. You see a bunch of it in Kingdom of Heaven, but because of Lord of the Rings, where they taught like armies of people how to fight with swords and, you know, they had armors on set, there seems to be this like reclaim of, okay, we went too far in the CGI direction. How do we now come back to like actually watching people smack each other and fall down? What do you think, Norm? Is that an accurate assessment?
I think there's definitely something to it. I think it's also because the CGI-est stuff in Lord of the Rings, the stuff that isn't Gollum, is very clearly artificial. I think at the time I was complaining that Two Towers just evolved into software fighting software.
My personal favorite part is the where Orlando Bloom goes sliding down on his little shield as he's like firing his arrows. And I was like, that was for the kids. Thank you very much.
It was. But I mean, you know, when you think about it, you're coming 5.5 hours into a movie and at that point, and the kids are falling asleep. So it's nice to have something they can identify with if they're watching it back to back.
And you need to make a toy where potentially Legolas is on like some sort of ramp and the toy just shoots down and does that. Like that's definitely a shot that's set up.
Now with boarding action, Legolas.
I would buy that. I would have bought that when I was 10.
The thing that Jackson does really well and always has, like even back as far as his horror movies in the 80s and 90s, is swooping ridiculous camera movements that just pull you along into the action. And he replicated those in The Lord of the Rings, but he couldn't do it practically. It was just impossible. So sometimes you have these artificial helicopter crane shots through masses of battling orcs and trolls and elves. And it just pulled me out every time in the theater thinking, oh yeah, okay, this is just digital. There's no way you can do this. It's like the Uruk-hai chant thing. He recorded the audio in a football stadium in Wellington, I think, which is just a delightful story. He got the entire crowd of a game to chant Uruk-hai chants because it
something
sounds
to tell
real.
The grandkids.
Yes. Yeah, but it sounds real. Yeah. It actually does read as an event that's happening. And then the image is just this totally artificial digital monster mash. So they pulled back from that. And this is no disrespect to Weta. They were doing the best they could at the time. You know, the digital effects took a long time to become as polished and indistinguishable from reality as they currently are. Although you can still tell when someone doesn't use them properly. But as a result, I think there was a push back to... It was also... The other thing I always forget is it was incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
CG is cheaper now. It's still really expensive. Proportionally, it's easier and cheaper to do. If you're making a big movie, at the time, if you wanted to make giant battle scenes, it would cost you half your budget potentially. So you either had to make a really expensive movie or justify it practically. And so I think Ridley Scott, certainly, he's a tactile filmmaker. He likes building things and making them real. And after Gladiator got knocked around for its CG, I think he clearly wanted to make something that was just more people in armor walking around. And to do that, you end up with duels and individual battles and confrontations with giant armies waiting in the background, which is also what Braveheart did. You know, in the end, it always comes down to Mel Gibson punching somebody or being punched. That's his deal. So that became the blueprint.
And with Gladiator, can you refresh my memory? A lot of the CGI, I remember it being, you know, very touted and very like, wow, how revolutionary is the Colosseum scenes. All of the crowd are, you know, CGI. And then it seemed to be very impressive. And today when you watch it, it looks really bad. So it is kind of fascinating with, you know, Kingdom of Heaven that, and I didn't know this before doing research, that Ridley Scott's very close friends with the King of Morocco at that time. And so the King of Morocco basically loaned him thousands of militia members. And so you're not getting those CGI people in this film. You're actually getting a bunch of real Moroccans who are both playing the for and against Jerusalem. Like they would switch costumes halfway through to then be the other side of the battle, which I find fascinating. And if you know, we're going to talk about Kingdom of Heaven probably with some caveats, but I will say that the battle scenes were pretty phenomenal. And that's something that Ridley Scott has carried forward in all of his filmography, including his most recent, not House of Gucci, battles in House of Gucci, but more specifically, the last duel.
All right. That having been said, let's get into our first movie, because you'd think after turning in stone-cold classics like Alien, Blade Runner, and Thelma and Louise, and Oscar darlings like Black Hawk Down and Gladiator, Ridley Scott would have earned his carte blanche from studio meddling. Sure, his career is dotted with some clunkers like Hannibal, and I recently revisited Black Rain. Oh, boy. But when you've been making movies for 5 decades, there's bound to be some misses. Ridley Scott, however, didn't get a final cut on his interpretation of The Crusades, Kingdom of Heaven, a movie that, to me, seems to exist because Scott looked at Lord of the Rings and said, "Hold my beer and send over Orlando Bloom." I say this knowing full well that Ridley loves himself an epic, as he's proved in years before. I'm looking at you, disturbingly moist Gerard Depardieu in 1942, The New World. And after, did anyone even see Exodus, Gods and Kings? Like Blade Runner, there are two versions of this movie out in the world, and one has been disowned by the filmmaker. Full disclosure, I only watched the one available on Disney+, which I believe is the theatrical cut,
yes,
knowing what I
correct.
Know. Alicia, which version did you see? Because I know Norm has seen both because he is a film trooper.
Yeah, I've seen both. So my first experience of this film, I didn't see it in theaters when it came out. And I'm happy because that means the first experience of this film I had was the director's cut, the cut that Ridley Scott remade, which is much longer. I believe it clocks in at 194 minutes versus, like, I think the Disney Plus version is 2 hours and 15. So I had seen that version and really loved the film, like just seeing it. I wasn't aware there was a different version. Now, what I did is same as you, Becky, for this podcast. I watched what's on Disney Plus and I am horrified.
Okay.
Horrified. But it's such, I'm hoping, I think we will have a really interesting conversation because I've never seen a director's cut be so different from the theatrical cut. And the idea that Disney Plus is, well, Disney in general, because this is a Fox film. It was produced for Fox. It was not produced for Disney, but of course Disney owns Fox. So this is why we have it on something like Disney Plus. The idea that Disney Plus is just slapping this on there in such an inferior version where you have full subplots, full characters, including Ava Green's character's son, completely cut out. So the story makes no sense whatsoever. And there's no character motivation. I'm shocked and baffled. And I'm sorry, Becky, I feel like you would maybe have enjoyed this more if you saw what Ridley Scott really wants us to see. And this is his most ultimate, like, transgressive director's cut, I feel like. He's gone back and re-edited everything, right? We get the Alien version that has extra scenes that I'm not a huge fan of because I think it kind of takes away the mystery of the Alien.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And but then this, I'm just like, oh, my God, no, I see his line of thinking. But then I'm also like, yeah, of course, making a film for Fox, you're not going to be allowed to make a 3-hour and 14-minute film. What were you thinking?
The fascinating thing is he did make it, right? Like, that's
and showed it to Fox.
These stories always fascinate me because, you know, it's like Kenneth Branagh going off and making Hamlet and shooting the entire play and just not telling Castle Rock that that was his plan all along. And then starting to talk about, oh, yeah, we shot the whole play. I mean, obviously, it'll come out. It's in 70 millimeter. It was incredibly expensive. They knew what was going on, but he had said he was going to deliver a 2.25-hour movie because that, back in the days of film, was the magic window of, I think, 7 reels instead of 8. So you didn't have to spring for another reel, which would, at the time, would inflate the cost of an individual print by hundreds of dollars.
And you could pack Cineplexes with more films per day, because as soon as you have a 3-hour-plus movie, then you're taking away from other ticket sales for other titles.
Exactly. Three shows max.
They did put in an intermission for Hamlet, so you could go get more snacks. So they did make their money.
My understanding of... No, but that intermission for Hamlet is just on the VHS. I don't think that was a theatrical
No, it is. As someone who saw Hamlet 3 times in the theater, because I do not think you understand how much I had a crush on Ken Branagh at the time. There was an intermission.
Yeah,
in the
I remember an intermission too. I also remember seeing it in one of the most uncomfortable theaters in Toronto.
All right. Well, I'm going to bring us back into Kingdom of Heaven. And I want to start us out by talking about the battle scenes, because I think those battle scenes are some of the best I've ever seen. Those siege towers are awesome. And that Ridley Scott storyboarded it, and that he storyboarded it by basically making a graphic novel comic book and passing it out to people and going, this is what it looks like. How else could you do this?
Yeah, I mean, he went as far to, this is filmed, a lot of it's filmed in Spain, standing in for parts of France and standing in for Jerusalem. There's also a lot of shots in Morocco. But, you know, for some of the buildings, like castles and things like that he needed to be France, he hired, like, Spanish artisans who were still using the techniques that were used for building thatched houses in the 12th century. Like, that was just a craftsmanship that still existed. And so he's going to that extent for buildings that appear in the background, like not even like prominent. So this is a little bit of a, like, James Cameron on Titanic making every White Star Line prop, even when you don't see it on camera. He's kind of going full OCD, obsessive with everything that you see in these battle scenes, including these towers, which are really interesting, that he did have built, did blow up, which, I mean, that's kind of the climax of the Disney Plus version. And it's really effective for all the reasons both you and Norm were talking about, Becky, that it's not CGI. Like, there's some CGI in this, but the scenes that aren't CGI in the battle, and I really felt the blood spray. I really felt like the sepsis setting into most of these wounds. We have a character who has leprosy. There's a little bit of a, like, Lon Chaney Phantom of the Opera reveal that I was fascinated by. And this is a character played by Edward Norton, who's uncredited because you only see him in a mask. It's Edward Norton doing his best, like, Marlon Brando voice, kind of from, like, Doctor of Island Moreau. It's very confusing.
Come forward. I am glad to meet Godfrey's son. He was one of my greatest teachers.
It's not method acting as we understand it, but it's the sitting around thinking, well, I guess his tongue would be swollen, and then just going with it.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't want to be credited because he wanted to keep the mystery of who the character was. But I'm like, we're in the age of the internet. Like, we can look this up almost immediately to find out where you were in the world and where you're being clicked by the paparazzi.
He also has a very distinctive voice.
Yeah. 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 And the mask looks like him. They made the mask to look very That's Edward Norton like. My guess is, I'm sure he and Scott had this idea that it would be shrouded in mystery. You would never know it's Edward Norton. And I think Fox was probably like, excuse me, like Edward Norton from Fight Club. This is like a point where we can, you know, absolute an American History X, like we can market this. And I'm sure they refused to allow him to be uncredited. So he is in the end titles. But I can't remember the complication. It's like only on the DVD versions or something like that, and not the theatrical version actually said what actor played it.
Yeah, it's probably Weird. A union thing. It's always a union
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Always a union thing. That's a great explanation yeah. for everything.
I want to bring us into the idea of, because it's become very relevant now with House of Gucci and The Last Duel, talking about Ridley Scott and accents in movies where he sets in countries that are not America yeah. or the UK. And I think that it's really interesting to me that he's like, I just need to get every grizzled white character actor from the UK. Jeremy Irons is in this, Liam Neeson is in this, and have them perform. Do you guys have a feeling about that? Like, does that bother you that Orlando Bloom is playing a Frenchman?
I think we need to start off with the caveat that Ridley Scott thinks all of his ideas are great mm-hmm. every time. And
he's
Ridley...
always very pleased with himself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. He thinks every movie he's made is that interview that came out with him just as House of Gucci was hitting
yes.
where the writer, the interviewer whose name escapes me, is just listing his films and Scott's answer to all of them is great movie, great movie. It's like, yeah. dude, no, I saw Prometheus. I saw Alien Covenant. You can't do that.
No.
But he also, in the space of a month or 6 weeks or however much time was between the release of The Last Duel and House of Gucci, reversed himself completely on the accent issue, because with The Last Duel, he was saying, of course, Ben Affleck has his own accent. They're not really speaking French. They're really speaking French. They're not really speaking English. What difference does it make? And he's right. It shouldn't make a difference. It is perfectly fine. I just saw The Tragedy of Macbeth, and mm-hmm. Denzel Washington does not affect a Scottish accent because he shouldn't. Mm-hmm. that would not work. Even if he got it perfectly right, no one would accept it. And so the Americans speak in American accents, the British actors speak in their own accents, and it's perfectly fine. It's Shakespeare. We're used to seeing different interpretations. Here, yeah, you know, just as in... My favorite example is Dr. Zhivago, where everyone's speaking Russian. The street signs are Cyrillic, but the actors are speaking English because what is the point? They're not trying to affect Russian accents because that would be silly. So with Kingdom of Heaven, as in The Last Duel, the actors use the voice. Well, I guess Norton kind of affects a British accent, doesn't he?
A little bit.
I was wondering if he was trying to match somebody else, because sometimes yeah. that happens. There'll be an accent corruption between actors in a given thing. So maybe he's trying to be, since he's Neeson's kid, he's trying to be a descendant somehow.
That's
I
point.
Think he's trying to make himself less posh is what I think he's doing.
Because
he has that very like schoolboy, like a public school sort of accent, which doesn't really work when you're playing this like scrappy blacksmith.
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's talk about Orlando Bloom for a second here, because I am not a Bloom fan. My sister had a huge crush on him when everything came out. He never really did it for me. Mm. And I think part of it is, for me, he is a cipher of an actor. He's very good at you projecting yourself onto him and going, yes, I want to be that swashbuckler. And it seems like they used him, number one, because he's very attractive, and number two, because in Lord of the Rings, he actually learned how to use a sword. So you're, you know, figuring out exactly what that looks like. And he has this Errol Flynnian quality to him that's very...
And that he's drunk and having sex with 14-year-olds all the time?
Well, he is with Katy Perry, so I don't know. But it's very classic Hollywood in that kind of like, there's a vapidity to it, but swashbuckling, I mean, it's why he's perfect for Pirates of the Caribbean. But I think Hollywood then didn't know what to do with him after we stopped making these movies. Like, he really isn't in that much that isn't voiceover now. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's interesting.
He's a pretty face to look at. He was very iconic hot in the early 2000s. And keep in mind, in 2004, so it was a year prior to this, he made Troy. So there's a real like kind of confluence, I think, between Troy and Kingdom of Heaven. You know, I don't, we're not mean on this podcast. I did read a review of this film that kind of referred to his role in this as like he's holding the fort for a better actor. And he's passable. That's actually a very mean thing to say.
Yeah.
But he's passable, but he doesn't improve the film. And I think, you know, it's not for us to speculate why he's not in more. I think it's just his moment has passed, or he's made a professional choice not to be in a lot. But he was Legolas. He did have a lot of girls buying that action figure, including myself, girls who would not normally buy action figures, getting their little Legolas because that was like very hot in 1999. And I think that's just kind of a carryover to this film. I don't think Ridley Scott is always brilliant at casting. I think if you go through his filmography, there's a lot of questionable performances that haven't helped his films. I don't want to focus so much on like Orlando Bloom for Kingdom of Heaven because he definitely doesn't improve the film. But there's a lot. Like, was there anything, Becky, that you did like about this film?
I like the battle. The battle scenes are fine. I knowing that there's a bigger plot line for Eva Green makes me curious about the theatrical cut because the director cut because in the theatrical she is giving nothing to do. Like she sleeps with him and you're like why? And then she wants to make him king and you're like why? And it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So then I read a bit and how I figured out I watched the theatrical. Cut is they're like, oh, the moments where she's with her son are heart-wrenching, and I was like, she has a son?
Yes. So she no plays idea what Queen was going on. Sibella, who is the sister to the leper king in this film played by Edward Norton. She's a horrible husband named Guy de something. I'm sorry, I cannot recall. Guy, let's just say. Bad marriage. And then in the director's cut, the way that Ridley Scott meant it, she has a son who is showing signs of leprosy as well. And the son would be the rightful heir to the throne when her brother dies. That complicates every motivation that she has in the film. And when you take that son character out, and I don't think this, there's she does ultimately poison her son to save him from the dismal pain and life that he will have as a leper that her brother has had to endure. It changes all of her political motivations. So she's playing a lot, it's very Succession. She's playing a lot of different parties and she's playing a lot of different sides. And so she's a complex politician in the director's cut. And in the theatrical cut, she's just like crying for no reason. None of her motivations for backing her husband Guy makes sense without the son being there.
She's a prop in the theatrical cut.
Yeah,
she barely functions. And I would actually, before we get too far into Eva Green, who is tremendously good in the director's cut, in the performance she is actually giving makes perfect sense from scene to scene. But also, you just understand the strength of the character and the pressures that she represents every time the character wanders into frame. In the theatrical cut, she just looks like she showed up. And she did, because there was a whole other scene that we didn't see that she's just emerged from. I would say the same about Bloom, though. Like it's a thankless role, too. Like the alien is just they think he's Luke Skywalker structurally. He's the right person in the right time with the right skills to do one thing. And it's not Bloom's fault that the character has no depth or dimension, but I did find it more interesting to watch him in the longer version, just because you can see him thinking here and there that he doesn't belong. The character starts to feel outmatched. And especially once you realize how much Sibella is doing behind the scenes that he's unaware of, that does directly affect him. He seems more like, or he feels more like a puppet or a pawn in the longer version. Whereas the theatrical cut just says, look at this guy, isn't he great? And you keep saying, not really. And in the
it's like in Jurassic World where they keep telling you how cool Chris Pratt is, but you're like, I don't see it. Can you please show me how cool he is rather than tell me?
I mean, that's fair. In almost every movie, it's just like, no, that's Chris Pratt. No, no, he's an action hero. No, no.
He's cool.
It's Chris Pratt. I just saw him drop his wallet. Like he kicked it under a rock. It's not his fault, but that's not working. But Bloom is like, I think he knows his character is outmatched. And that hesitancy that got cut out of the shorter version disarms the character in our understanding of him. So the first time I saw it, I thought, oh, this guy's a black hole of charisma. He's not doing anything. He's just he's at the mercy of fate from scene to scene. Oh, I happen to be the son of this guy. I happen to go on this quest. And in the longer version, there are moments where he just seems to be struggling with that same thing. So at least his casting makes more sense.
Yeah. I mean, so much of the longer version comes down to the theme of religious hypocrisy. And, you know, this when this film was released, it, you know, it's 2005, it's not that long after 9/11. And nothing has really changed, unfortunately, with relations with Muslim countries. But like there was a lot of concern that because the Muslim culture was portrayed positively in this film, that it would ignite terrorism. Like it's ridiculous arguments when you read them today. But so much of the film is about religious hypocrisy, and that gets cut out in the theatrical version and becomes a sword and shield love story that does not work. So I don't know, Becky, I feel like you're going to get mad, but I think you have to watch the 3 hour and 14 minute. But it is a different film. I can't think of another example where a director's cut and a theatrical cut are so dissimilar. Like, we have a lot of director's cuts for Ridley Scott, especially. It's always just added on scenes. It's never like the entire point of the film has changed.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of
another example.
There is some. Well, I mean, obviously, Spartacus, like the films that this is inspired by directly.
Great points.
There are missing scenes in Spartacus that do clarify things, but they don't change the direction of the film as this one does. They don't reshape your understanding of crucial.
They just add some wonderful homoeroticism that I'm there for and wish I had seen when we watched it in grade 5.
Yeah, and a guy gets his arm cut off. That's awesome.
Yes.
I would maybe argue Lawrence of Arabia, not just because it's my favorite film, but because that director's cut, that restoration is a radical reconfiguring.
Which I guess is the only way I've seen it. I've only seen it in 70 at Cinematheque Ontario. So that would have been that cut. I don't, I'm really ignorant of what the original roadshow would have been back in the day in the 60s.
It was similar, but it moved too quickly. It just
interesting
leapfrogged past a couple of key moments of development
like
to just give you a context for O'Toole's performance and for the character of T.A. Lawrence. Kingdom of Heaven, I mean, it does the same for Eva Green, although it more than makes us understand her, it makes us feel for her, which just isn't possible in the theatrical cut. She's just
she poisons her son, and you have to watch that. Like, it's incredible.
She's giving it. Like, it's a real performance. She doesn't undersell anything.
Her. Oh, God,
and her tendency to go big really works here.
Yeah.
Having said that, it makes sense that she refused to do any press for this when she saw the theatrical cut. Yeah. When she saw how much was cut out, she refused to go on the publicity circuit, which makes sense. And she also said it was in solidarity with Ridley, which, you know, that's a great way to get more work. So I completely understand.
Yeah, and Scott was apologizing for it on the press tour, which I think is the only time he's done that. And just said, oh, we cut an hour out of this movie. I don't like it anymore. Which, again, kind of a dick move, but not totally unjustified in this case. I think he hinted at a longer cut of Gods and Kings, but that's never surfaced, and I'm fine with it because the version we have, it's 2.5 hours long, it's terrible, and I don't know that there's a point in making it I don't think that one can be made any better by making it longer.
I would like to see a 4-hour House of Gucci. I want to see everything that was cut out. Like, I want more Versace, I want more Tom Ford. I mean, I'm kidding. I say this in jest. I don't want that.
You're going to make it happen. You're going to conjure it just by saying so.
Is this your Christmas wish? Is this what you're going to burn it on? Not Goodwill Toward Men? You're like, 4-hour long House of Gucci. That's what I want for the world.
No.
Gene Siskel once said that there are some movies you watch and all you can think of is, I would rather watch the same running time of the actors having lunch.
Is that when My Dinner with Andre was?
I think that's the ideal, right?
All right, I'm taking us away from House of Gucci.
Please. I mean, it's technically germane with Ridley Scott and all. And another one that I don't think is going to get a longer cut because I can't imagine, as great as he thinks all of his movies are, I can't imagine him wanting to revisit that anytime soon.
Well, I want to bring us into a character actor that continued on with Ridley Scott, who I really like his work. Now, I'm like, where do I recognize him from? And that's Ghassan Massoud, who went on to be in a ton more of his stuff.
MVP
He's
of
one of the
film.
Main characters. Exactly. He's also in Exodus Gods and Kings, which, you know, maybe I'll watch it just for him because he's really something special in this. And then he went on to do like Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. Like he then becomes like the same kind of, he's got a great look for this kind of action star. And I like him a lot. Mm-hmm. I like his performance and I like how anchored he is. And it's nice to see a character who's Syrian not fly off the handle and just play a, you know, straightforward, I am just trying to do what's best for my folks.
And
you know what I mean?
I'm into it. He is 100% more fleshed out in the longer version, has more scenes that are really riveting. And so I don't know, Becky, I think you got to do it. I think you guys got to find 3 hours and 14 minutes and we'll re-record this episode.
in my day, which I have. I don't know. I feel like it's probably best that I came into this that not having seen both versions, because now I can be the audience surrogate of like, guys, I have no idea what's going on here.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right. That having been said, let's go into a movie where I did watch one. I watched two of the three versions just to see what was going on in this one.
Wow.
We're going to be talking about The New World, and that's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Terrence Malick isn't for everyone, with his dreamy imagery and narration and atypical storytelling. But he is an art house darling, a Persephone of sorts emerging every few years from development hell to deliver us an ethereal film that will simultaneously entrance and confound. Before Malick released The New World, his last film was 1998's The Thin Red Line, which shares a lot of similarities with our film today. And even though that was both a commercial and a critical success, as almost all his films have been, as we mentioned before, this was another case of the studio altering the film from its original version for something they deemed more palatable for a wider audience. Norm, do you want to walk us through the plot of The New World, one of the three, before we kind of try to get into what they all are?
Yes, Norm, please walk us through the plot.
Well, you know, there is a plot in The New World. There is structure and an A to B to C progression, and that is the experience of Pocahontas and the Iroquois as the English colonists and settlers arrive in what will eventually become America. That is the logline, that is the plot of The New World. In execution, of course, it's nothing like that at all, because Malick doesn't tell linear stories. He creates these intuitive experiences of what it would have been like to be on the ground at the time and just exist with them. His thing is to just glide along and chase a moment. And that can be incredibly clumsy in some cases, but more often than not, he finds the thing he wants to show us and puts us into the headspace of the people in these worlds that he builds for the movies. Took a long time, I have to admit, coming back around to liking The Thin Red Line and The New World. I found them both incredibly self-indulgent the first time through in 1998 and 2005, respectively. And we can talk about the various experiences I've had of The New World, because I've seen all three cuts because I was around for all of them.
Yeah.
The 150-minute version was screened for critics in Toronto, but not released in theaters here. It in between our seeing it for TFCA consideration, so it would have been like the first week of December at the very latest, and the release at Christmas, he cut another 15 minutes out of it. And it wasn't the studio. It's Malick, who just keeps cutting, who just keeps working his movies over and over again. And I think somehow he has a sweet spot of 3 hours and no one will let him have that running time. So he just keeps coming. He keeps fighting against it and coming back to it. I mean, The Tree of Life at 2.5 hours is pretty much perfect, but the longer cut is by no means bad. It's just more. The Thin Red Line is 3 hours long and it's exactly what it should be. A Hidden Life is exactly 3 hours long and it's exactly what it should be. The New World wasn't 3 hours long until 2016, 10 years later with the Criterion release, when he finally restored his cut. And that's exactly what it should be. And the shorter versions, by shorter, I mean 2.25 and 2.5 hours, the shorter versions are fighting against the rhythms that he already knows are right. And you can always feel when he's cutting something for someone else. I mean, their studio imposed cuts, but the studio never took it away from him. He just kept delivering different versions and they kept releasing them because New Line honored that. But it wasn't until the Criterion 4K restoration that he got to make the movie. He got to create the movie he'd always had in mind. And that movie is this strange, beautiful story of alienation. It's about people who don't belong in the places they are, finding ways to contribute. What happens with John Smith, Colin Farrell's character, who, you know, I guess, first of all, we should roll back to the Disney Pocahontas and say that
yes.
That is not this movie. And people who are surprised that they don't immediately speak each other's language or sing to each other, thanks to the magic tree, you can do a report on Pocahontas from Disney and you can do a report on Pocahontas from Malick. And in both cases, your teacher will mark you wrong because neither of those is accurate. But what Malick is getting to in his film is how it felt, not what happened, but how it felt to people. There's a scene where,
the psychology of it.
Yeah. Well, and the emotional reality of being completely foreign and surrounded by people who not only don't speak your language, but don't look like you, don't dress like you, don't act like you. And we get it from John Smith's perspective at first, but then gradually you realize that Pocahontas has been experiencing this exact thing all along, the more time she spends with him. And the focus very subtly, almost, I hate the word ineffable, but this is where it's appropriate, inevitably shifts to her. Mm-hmm. And Koryanka Kilcher has been at the center of the film the entire time. She's always around, even when you don't expect her to be. She pops up here and there in the backgrounds of shots when it's supposed to be focused on the English. And gradually you understand that her experience of this is at least as important as the Westerners who think they're Westerners. She's actually more Western because those people were further west than England. But there's this contradiction of who belongs where and who belongs to whom that rolls through the entire film and that Malick explores. I just rewatched the longer cut last night or two nights ago. And I'd forgotten just how much Colin Farrell gets to do in the scenes when he's surrounded by the indigenous people. Like, he is projecting caution, but friendliness and cooperation. He's always helping people. He's always doing something to ingratiate himself even further, which makes it even more tragic that we know where all of this is going. And I think that's something floating throughout the film as well.
It's so interesting. I mean, obviously for Becky and my generation, Pocahontas was very much in our childhood. There is a way that Terrence Malick plays with the Disneyfication of that story by casting Irene Bedard, who was the voice of the animated Pocahontas, as Koryanka Kilcher's mother in this film that you only see. So all this film is obviously insular, monologues, basically, like hearing the interior thoughts of its characters, mainly three of them. But obviously, Koryanka Kilcher's character is the most important. And so you hear her talk. You never meet her mother necessarily. We see her on screen. She's remembering her memories of her mother. Mm-hmm. She's having a dialogue with her mother, trying to process everything around her with her mother's life, which wouldn't have included, the English coming over. And it's just there's so much nuance in this film, and there's so much that Terrence Malick is doing that I didn't see the first time. Like, I have had to watch this film. It's like an onion. You just keep peeling back the layers to the point where I really, really love this. And it was a problematic film for me when I first saw it, probably around 2006, 2007, but I wasn't prepared for it. And it's crazy to think this is only his fourth feature. The gap that he took between Days of Heaven, which is 78, and The Thin Red Line, which is 90, 20 years. And so it was such a big deal. And I'm sure, Norm, you can talk to this. It was such a big deal when this came out in 2005. Because, 98 to 2005 is an unusual gap in a filmmaker's career, but not unusual for Terrence Malick, who had done it even longer. And now we have a new film from him every year that people are very angry about. And I watch them all, and I love them all. I'm like probably a Terrence Malick apologist. But I don't feel like I need to apologize for The New World, because when you watch that longer cut, and I've never seen the other cuts, to be honest. Or I guess I've seen the 150-minute. Somehow I would have seen that. I think Cinemateca did it back in like 2008 or something like that.
Yeah, that would have been the print they had, right? I mean, that would have been what was available here.
that's true. That would have been the print. It's so complicated. There's a lot about this film that's problematic. We should just say right now, Koryanka Kilcher, who very prominent actress now, I was looking at her filmography. I was like, oh my God, that's her. I didn't recognize her as an adult, but she's, I believe 16 when she filmed this.
She's 14. She is 14 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously Colin Farrell is quite a bit older than 14 right. in 2005.
But that is an accurate representation, right, of what was happening. So that's what I mean about...
No, she was 10. Pocahontas, by their estimates, was 10 years old. So they're aging her up for appropriateness.
Well, I mean the age gap.
Which is 14. Correct. Yeah.
No, but of course, it's not appropriate at all. And that's what I mean. Like the whole, but the problematic stuff is built into the film and it acknowledges it. I mean, the whole thing is about white people coming in and invading and taking.
And eroticizing.
I get that. But what I don't understand is why we keep romanticizing Pocahontas. Because we don't do the same thing to Sacagawea, who basically played the same role in American history. So I don't know why, as a general consensus we have come to, is that, hey, these two were star-crossed lovers, and we really like to romanticize these two, didn't happen.
I don't know that the film is doing that.
I'm not saying that's right, but where I do...
There are long, lengthy monologues about how in love they are with each other, which if you're watching this, not from your excellent, astute, critical eye, Norm, because as you're saying this, I'm like, okay, now I get it. But watching this from a plebeian like myself, I'm like, this is a love story, and that's what they've made. And I think what I'm fascinated about with all the different cuts is because no one knows what this was meant to be. Anyone making this. Terrence Malick didn't know what it was supposed to be. He is famously now enemies with James Horner, who's like one of the biggest composers on the planet, because James Horner was trying to score this and he kept taking it back and going, nope, that's not what it is. Chop, chop, chop. And Horner was screaming at him going, it is a love story. Just make it a love story and let me score it like a love story.
But there's different layers of the love story, right? So we have, and I will go back, just to rewind. A lot of this is taken from John Smith's extremely suspect journals that he wrote in between 1607 and like 1620. And so a lot of that romanticization of Pocahontas, and we should say that that name, Pocahontas, never appears in this film.
Yes, ever. Deliberately, because it's not her name. It was a name that was assigned to her.
She eventually adopts the name Rebecca, but, you know, yes, it's not, it was never her name. It's an anglicization of the group of people she came from doesn't exist. So yeah.
I screwed up and called I called them Iroquois, or I called the dialect Iroquois earlier. That's completely wrong. It's Algonquin, and in fact, they're trying to speak Powhatan, right? Which was an extinct language that was reconstructed by a linguistics professor for the actors in the film. So language they're speaking doesn't technically exist either. It's an approximation.
It's also how they got all of the indigenous actors involved, and why they were able to get a lot of the access to a lot of the filming locations they had is because they promised, hey, we're going to be resurrecting these things. There's going to be a lot of film time for this, which also didn't happen, which pissed off a lot of the indigenous communities, including one of the actors, Wes Studi, who you know him from everything. Sure. If you need an indigenous actor, he's in it. He's also an activist. And he himself has said, give me the footage because I want to do a cut, because I know what we filmed and I know what should be on that screen. It's fascinating to me.
Yes, this is it's a hard film to talk about, and it's hard for me to acknowledge how much I love this. I'm swept away by this film. But, you know, the levels of like romance, of course you're going to, what Malick film, even The Thin Red Line, has like a love story. That's always at the heart. But they're always complicated. They're always blocked by isolation or by the landscape, which is a great case for this film as well. But you also have the love story between Christian Bale's character, who we haven't even brought up, who is the second half. And this is the real person that Pocahontas ended up marrying and was then brought back to England and kind of put on display for the queen. I think it would have been Queen Anne at the time. That's a story that the Disney version stops. We don't see that.
No, that's the sequel. There is a sequel to Pocahontas where that happens.
Right. I forgot about that. It's terrible.
I would imagine it is. But I'm finding it hard to defend this film. Becky, would you say you're a Malick? Here's the thing, because I kind of know you well enough to know you don't like Terrence Malick, and this would not be the film to watch if you're not a fan of Terrence Malick.
To win me over. I like and appreciate Days of Heaven. I really like Badlands. I think Badlands is very cool and very unusual, and I'm hoping we get to talk about it in our next season because it is in one of those years, because I really like that, and I think it's very neat.
We will.
I find him too ethereal for me, and I think that's why. Is it like Lynch gives me, like, he's got a similar thing going to Lynch, where you need to experience Lynch to enjoy him. And I don't know if I enjoy the experience of Malick as much as I enjoy the experience of Lynch.
That's fair. I read a review of this that referred to it as a Tony Scott movie on Quaaludes. And we do have an episode in season one of this podcast that is dedicated to 1492 Conquest of Paradise and Christopher Columbus the Discovery. It's one of our, I think, most hilarious episodes.
So fun.
I will have to look that up because
it's pretty fun.
I have angry memories about both of those films.
Oh, we get pretty heated. But I love that Tony Scott movie on Quaalude. I love Tony Scott movies, FYI. But
that's Ridley. Ridley did that one.
Right. Sorry. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
No, The Hunger is Tony.
Yes. Yes.
Which is also very dreamy, gauzy, ethereal, lesbian sex scenes, everybody's happy.
Got it. I'm still a fan of Tony. But yeah, if you think about how the gestation of this project, so Malick is writing it in the 1970s, around the time that he's producing Days of Heaven. He's writing it during the height of the Vietnam War. He's writing it around the what was then called the American Indian Movement, which is kind of like the first wave of indigenous rights. And it takes, as we know, as he's wont to do, takes then, you know, 4 decades, or I guess like 3 decades to actually get this off the ground. I'm not saying he was the man to make the ultimate film of this story. I'm not saying that at all. Like I hope we get a different perspective. What I'm saying though is, as a film, I absolutely am swept away by this. And if you take out the historical accuracy the same way that we do with Kingdom of Heaven, and one of the terms that Ridley Scott uses, which I didn't mention earlier, is he refers to his act as creative accuracy. So I think, which is bullshit, but like,
yeah, of course he would come up with that phrase.
And Terrence Malick would never bother, he would never deign to say something like that, because this man doesn't talk to press and he doesn't give interviews. I was there for one of the very first public appearances he made decades after decades of never being seen. There's a question of, was he even alive? I'll go back to that in a second. But like, he's really, the creative accuracy is there in this film too, where it's much more, coming back to Norm's points, about the feelings, the interior monologues, the way that, you know, a bug is flying in the air and then all of a sudden the camera lingers on it, which drives a lot of people insane, including many of the actors.
Can we just say just for a second that also Christopher Plummer was enraged by him because he got Adrian Brody'd in this, where they basically took all of it out. And then he shows up at the premiere and goes, where's my role? But when he was acting on set, he would be like, oh, can you stop for a second? I see an Osprey. Can we turn the camera to the Osprey?
I like that. I love that they thought they couldn't, when they're doing location scouting, they really felt they couldn't film in Virginia around the site where this, you know, these occurrences took place. And then they realized a lot of the Virginia coastline is actually untouched, and had not the same kinds of birds that they needed, but similar birds. And there are moments of CGI in this film which blow my mind, because they went in and recolored the birds that are now extinct to look like they would have in 1606. Like, it's exhausting. This is an exhausting film that I find I'm exhausted even talking about, but is worth it for me. I don't know. Yeah. Like, you've never interviewed Terrence Malick, right, Norm?
No, I've interviewed people who've worked with him, and they protect him. They wouldn't.
Yes.
The most honest conversation I've ever had about Terrence Malick, I think, was Martin Sheen, when he came through on The Walk with Emilio Estevez directing that. And the two of them were doing the father-son act that they do in the movie, where just sort of building out on the fact that they don't have any scenes together in the film except flashbacks. And then this is them in the present day. And they're talking about how, I think it was Sheen who said, like, basically, when you see the two of us on screen, you're seeing our entire history. And I said, well, obviously he also has that period where he looks just like you in Badlands. And then that got him into talking about Malick a little bit. And he's like, you know, I still see Terry. We talk about basketball a lot.
Here's my
experience. Made me so happy.
Yeah. Terry does love. He is Terry. Had a wondrous Austin like escapade around South by Southwest, but I wasn't there for South by. I ended up staying for South by, and it was the year that Song to Song was premiering, which is a film I really like and no one else does. But it was the first onstage conversation that Terrence Malick had ever agreed to do. And I think it was very quiet. They weren't advertising it, but I was there at 8 a.m. for a 10 a.m. event just to be like, because I was like, if you're telling me I get to like be in an audience watching Terrence Malick talk about his films, I'm going to miss any screening, any concert, who cares? And he was being interviewed by Richard Linklater and Michael Fassbender. And he sat for an hour on the stage, didn't really say anything, nodded his head a lot to the questions, and then walked out. And it's just like, yeah, that's exactly what I expected. Song to song, he doesn't want to talk about his films. He can't talk about his films. The actors, like Michael Fassbender, talked a lot about the experience of delivering this incredible monologue, something that's really important to the film. And then out of the corner of his eye, seeing Terrence Malick and the cinematographer, Lubezki, who's the same cinematographer for this film, start filming a grasshopper, like in the grass. And so he knows that like the scene that he's giving is not being recorded. And watching that film song to song, there's a lot of like crickets and grasshoppers. It's infuriating. I see so much of that in The New World, where he was clearly, and I see what you're saying, Becky, there's a lot of scenes probably that he was historically researching and bringing in academics and bringing in indigenous advisors, and they didn't make the cut. And so they're angry, but it's much more about the sound of birds and the sound of the grass and the way that these houses and huts are constructed and the gangrene and the sepsis and the I can smell this film.
Yeah.
And I wish you had seen it in theaters, because I having just watched it, same as you, Norm, 2 nights ago for the podcast, I can't remember how I got it, but watching on a rather large TV doesn't cut it. This is a theatrical experience. This has to be in surround sound. You have to feel like these birds from 1600 are behind you. It's almost like a 4D film for me.
Yeah, he creates.
That's crazy.
He creates immersive experiences, right? I mean, that's the reality of it. He is chasing, personally, he is always chasing a rapture of some sort. And whether that is, you know, in A Hidden Life, where you watch a man just simply refuse to be a bad person while surrounded by them and pay for it with his life, and you finally understand the thing that he was chasing, which is just being true to oneself and his convictions. It's so simple, and yet you've just spent 3 hours watching this illustration and elaboration of it. The New World picks right up where The Thin Red Line leaves off, with these this glimpses of the indigenous peoples in Guadalcanal in the South Pacific that Jim Caviezel's character is seen frolicking with. He goes AWOL at the beginning of the film, and that's where we find him. And in the end, those are the memories that sustain him into death, you know, ultimately. This film starts where that stopped, or at least in the extended cut, the 3 hour cut, which I guess we should call the director's cut now. We pick right up with just bodies in water, people swimming, people uncorrupted by civilization as we the Western audience watching the movie understands it. And we're constantly being shown that our perspective is just one perspective in the New World, because we know where these stories are going. And that's the thing that I didn't really dig into before. Everyone in this is going to die horribly. Everybody who is on the screen now, whether they go to England and get smallpox, whether they just die of a bad tooth, whether a musket ball lodges in their brain, every single one of these people is going to die badly because these cultures have collided. And it's about, you know, you can use biblical terms. I know Malick does fairly often. Although his speeches, the monologues that he gives his characters in voiceover are always quasi-religious at best. He doesn't really believe in Christian iconography or anything beyond some sort of natural divinity of the undisturbed world. So, in fact, the indigenous characters, when we hear Pocahontas's monologue, Madawaka's monologue, it's about mother. It could be the earth. It probably is, but it might be about her mother, because we see her mother, as you mentioned, that's there to cloud our perception and make us understand that we cannot understand her. And John Smith's diaries, his journals are, you know, kind of, they're verbose. They're lugubrious, I think is a great word, where he just goes on and on about the nobility of the savage. And it's absolutely wrong. But that's what his perspective was, and we get to share it for a little while. And then there's that scene with the the incredibly young and magnetic Michael Gray Eyes, who I'd forgotten was in the film, just discovering a canon. And Malick doesn't, the English around him mock him for not knowing what the canon is. And he's like, oh, it's yours. Pick it up. Try to lift it. And Malick doesn't care about that. Malick cares about his fascination. And he's interested in this actor's performance of discovery. And it's just a 3-minute scene in this giant movie. But we know that person inside and out in that moment because we get to see the joy in his face of finding something new and that he's open to it and that he's interested in it. And again, these people will eventually kill him. It might not be them immediately. It might not be the people he's next to, but it's their society. And this weapon is the thing that will destroy his people. And I don't think the film ever lets you off the hook about that, about understanding that what you're watching, no matter how romantic and how in love with itself in the moment the movie is, it's a tragedy.
That's there in the love story too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we do see the reunite. So John Smith, and this did, I think, historically happen. Pocahontas is lied to, and it's said that, no, this didn't happen. This is definitely part of the fictional, the creative accuracy, if you will. You know, she's lied to and said that he's died on the passage so that she can move on. And that's how she marries John Rolfe, which is Christian Bale's character. But we do see them reunite in London, John Smith and Pocahontas, and like that, oh my God, because we've also just been watching like 2 hours and 45 minutes of a film. So I'm like so invested, and it really demystifies John Smith. Like, he's just a swashbuckling moron, basically. Like,
yeah, he's basically a privateer, right? He just showed up on this. He's introduced in irons. He's not a good person.
Not a good person. He's trying to find the West Indies. He ends up in Greenland, I think. And they shot that maybe in Scotland. I can't remember where, but, it demystifies the love story. Like, you see her come full circle too, where she's realizing, okay, well, I was 12 or 13 or 14 based on the actress's age in love with this man. And now I'm an adult with a child, and it was all fiction. It was all just circumstance of, you know, the romanticization of that discovery, of that discovery story. It was a moment of empathy for me where I never thought I'd be able to relate to the character of Pocahontas, but that is a moment where I did, where you just like get over an old love, or you get over realizing a relationship that you've held up on a pedestal never deserved it in the first place.
Yeah. And Bale's character, Rolfe, gets a lot more screen time in the longer cuts as well, because the version, the first version I saw is the classic Terrence Malick moment of, oh, that's Christian Bale, and you never see him again. you get this little moment of, I wonder how long he was around, because that feels like it took a lot of work. And then you see the work in the longer cut and realize, oh, yeah, there was a plan. It's not what Malick decided to go with in the end. I think he just shoots his options. Jessica Chastain once talked about shooting the kitchen scene in The Tree of Life, where she receives a phone call that someone has died. And she said they shot it for 2 weeks with Malick over her shoulder operating the camera himself. And she gave a different performance every time because that's what they wanted. And sometimes Brad Pitt was off camera. Sometimes he wasn't there at all. And they just kept shooting this take. And, you know, it's like people who start off with bullet points for a script. They have the scenes they want. They don't know exactly how it's going to play. They leave it to the actors to improvise it. Just imagine doing that on a grand scale, perhaps for months at a time, and then having all that footage to sift through. I think digital has actually allowed Malick to work faster, both shooting and cutting, because now he's releasing a movie, as you say, like every year or so.
He shot 1 million feet of footage for The New World.
Yeah.
One of the articles I read said that at one point they had 4 head editors and 15 assistant editors working on this. And then as people started to realize what kind of an ordeal this was going to be, they all just left. And then the assistant editors came in and then just were doing the work. Like, apparently it was just an absolute gong show. But I mean, Terrence Malick is an artist. Like, I just have to be clear. He's not a filmmaker. He's an artist. I think that's what it is. Like, you have to feel, it's the same as when we were watching W.R. Mysteries of the Organism. Like, stuff just feels right for him. And so as you watch it, you should kind of feel the same thing. He's looking for a feeling rather than a story.
Absolutely.
Am I wrong?
No, you're totally right.
I mean, he is a filmmaker. He's doing this in a medium that he could not be doing it in any other medium. I mean, there are no Terrence Malick, audio CD experiences. There are no Terrence Malick computer games. It has to be a film.
Yeah, yeah, he's not a journeyman. He makes the movie that he's passionate about, and that's all he makes. He never has to take one for the team to be able to make that movie. For some reason, people keep being like, here, have a bunch of money to read about indigenous building sites for 2.5 years. Like, and that's what blows my mind, is that people love him and his work enough. Because this doesn't happen, that people would just be like, here's some money just to research a project that may or may not happen. That's fascinating.
I think a lot of what, he works with a lot of young and up-and-coming, you know, cinematographers, for instance, like Lubetzky would go on to do Children of Men, The Revenant, Gravity. He's still shooting all of Malick's films.
Yeah, he always comes back to work with Malick, which I think is...
Yeah, there's very few people who... I mean, Jack Fisk, the production design on this, down to every nail that had to be accurate to the 17th century. Jack Fisk was, you know, the production designer on Badlands. He has worked on, I think, every single Malick, and he's still with him. Maybe not super recently because he's retired. You know, he marries Sissy Spacek, like the... meet on Badlands. Like, there's such a genealogy here of Malick working for the first time in the 70s and 73 with Badlands. He had a short prior to that. And he has fostered careers that have been so important to cinematic history. But I do feel like we don't pay enough attention to him currently. A Hidden Life was wonderful because it was the first time he'd gotten really like stellar critical reviews for a recent production. I'm a big fan of Knight of Cups. Like I said, huge fan of Song to Song. Mm-hmm. I could probably leave To the Wonder, but we don't need to talk about that.
To the Wonder is the one where I keep thinking, well, I heard Chastain was cut out of that entirely. And yes. I'm like, I think I'd like to see that footage. I think that might make some more sense.
Well, that's what's interesting about this is, you know, he's a man who is older, obviously, clearly. I think he's in his 70s, maybe if not early 80s.
I think he's like 79 or 80 now.
He's going to pass away, and he lives on a farm like outside of Austin, like way in the, like, no, you'll never find him. Like, someone told me the address once. I was like, no one will ever find that. And I'm so curious about the archive, like as an archivist, as someone who comes from a film restoration background and film preservation, I'm just like, where are these outtakes? Where are you storing the million feet of footage? Tell me you have a salt mine somewhere on your property that when the estate is settled, like what's, I know that he has, someone told me, so I was in Austin, I was dealing with a lot of people who are very close to him, never got close to him myself, but had enough great experiences of people telling me personal stories of Terry. He definitely has a university earmarked that everything is going to go to that poor university, because what are they sifting through? Like, you know, most university film archives don't take B-roll, but how could you not take Terrence Malick B-roll? Because I think out of the kind of limited, I think he has maybe 12 films, maybe less, like you could probably produce 50 films out of just the footage of Jessica Chastain that was cut from To the Wonder, and that's a whole nother film.
On this note, Alicia, just because we have to wrap up, I just want to say, which version, if someone is only going to sit through one three-hour version, which version do you think that people should watch?
I think, unlike Kingdom of Heaven, I'm okay with people watching any version. I don't think I haven't seen that hour and 30 minute. So, I mean, if you had to pick one, let's say the 150, I would watch that first. If you have, what I would say is what's most important, seeing this in a place where you can shut out all else. I was trying to take notes, you know, while watching this. I was, my cell phone, I like, don't do that. If you have any opportunity to see this theatrically, and I don't know where in this day and age that's ever going to happen, but if you have that chance, you have to do it. And if you don't have that ability, which would be most of us, find the ability to just sit there and watch it. Do not do all the distracted things. Try to watch it as big as you can on a proper, like that 4K Criterion is stunning. Like, I would do that. It's not about the version for me. It's about where you are, if that makes sense.
Norm, do you want to add on to that? Or are you like, nope, that's it?
It does make a lot of sense. I cannot imagine anyone watching a Terrence Malick movie on a laptop. I know people do.
Yeah, you have to.
And
yeah,
it's inevitable, right? I mean, it's unavoidable if that's what you've got. But it's he makes movies to be lost in. I would endorse the full three-hour cut. It's the movie he ultimately chose to release and wanted to be seen. The other two versions are included on the Criterion Blu-ray release because that way, yeah, they're three separate discs, actually, one of each.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it's great because that way you can understand the pressures he was under and the things he thought were less important at the time. And then you see the full version and that just makes more sense. It's not unlike the experience of coming to Kingdom of Heaven after seeing the theatrical cut. You need to know what's not there to recognize and appreciate it when you do see it. Although I would also love the chance to have seen the proper version first. I just, my line of work, I just never get to do that. I'm always catching up. But yeah, I would say the 3-hour version, like A Hidden Life, like The Thin Red Line, his 3-hour films seem to sing. They have the rhythms right, and they make an eloquent argument. Plus, you just get Christian Bale in a way that the other two versions don't.
Yeah. And we all need a little bit more Christian Bale in our life, I understand.
You certainly think so.
That's right. Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us once again. And I hope our little banter was enriched both you and I in our understanding each other's viewing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thank you, Becky. I appreciate when we designed this episode, I knew that this was a very difficult task, and also assigning potentially 6 hours of viewing, whereas, you know, normally when we do 2 animated films, we can get away with like 2 hours and 10 minutes. So I also want to thank Norm, because Norm was given multiple options of episodes. Mm-hmm. And there was one that I thought was best for him, that but I threw this in there just on a whim, and I was just so pleased when you're like, you're going to need someone. And I was like, yep, we're going to need someone like you to do this. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Norm, for joining us. Can you please let people know where they can hear more of you and your excellent takes on films and interviews?
Oh, you're so kind. I am everywhere by design. You can find my podcasting work at Someone Else's Movie, which is on your podcast platforms everywhere, where I interview a writer, actor, director, or a nebulous industry figure about a movie they love but had no connection to when it was made.
I love that concept. That is brilliant.
Other people are doing it now, and they're all doing it less good than me. That's all I can say. Because you inevitably get it's an advocacy program. I started out because I was tired of all the other podcasts that were about how terrible movies were. We know. And I wanted to do something where you got to stand up for a movie that you love. And it turns out that getting someone to talk about something they love is actually the direct line into who they really are. So,
and it's funner to, honestly, for me, it's funner to listen to. I want to hear about what people love rather than what they don't. Do you know what I mean?
Because
hopefully then I'll love it too. And often you will convince me that, yes, I will love it too. Thank you. More things I can love.
That's
the
goal.
On this podcast, it's not that we always love everything, but one of the ways that this podcast has been important for Cam, myself, and Becky is that we do not insult the films. Like, I am so tired of those, like, making fun of films. And there's bad films we talk about all the time, but we try to find an inroad to at least express some passion about it.
That's how you get people to watch things too. I mean, it's about making sure that the good stuff gets talked about. And the other podcast I do is Now What, which is the Now Magazine podcast, where every week we push out a story about the news and culture we think you should know. So we've done a lot of episodes on COVID. That's how it started. But now we're sort of trending away from that and trying to find reasons to be happy. So in a way, that's an advocacy show as well.
Excellent. And you can join us next week as we watch 2 movies I am very passionate about. Alicia will be sitting out because they are 2 of the more disturbing horror movies you will see in your time. We're watching The Descent and Noroi. That's coming up next week.
Oh boy.
Yeah, nope. I'm not doing it.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Alicia Fletcher and Norm Wilner as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.